Hello, everyone, and thank you for joining today's webinar. I'm Jim Doyle, President of Business Forward. I'll be moderating our conversation today. Currently, all lines are in listen-only mode. Today, the Commerce Department announced that the U.S. economy grew at 3% in the third quarter. Join us to provide analysis on what that means for American businesses and the different factors driving the economy is Bob Carroll. Bob is a principal at EY and the national director of their Quantitative Economics and Statistics Groups. He also served as Deputy Assistant Secretary for Tax Analysis of the U.S. Treasury Department, where he served as the department's top economist working on tax policy issues. Today's webinar is part of our quarterly GDP series. It's an interactive webinar, so after the presentation, we'll open up to you for questions. For those of you who are new to our programming, Business Forward organizes local roundtables, Washington fly-ins, conference calls, webinars, and media trainings for more than 100,000 business leaders across the United States. At these briefings, entrepreneurs, investors, small business owners, and executives get the chance to brief policymakers on issues affecting their businesses. To date, more than 600 senior administration officials, members of Congress, governors, and mayors have participated in our programming, and this is all thanks to the support of more than 60 of America's largest and most respected companies. Before we get started, I need to cover a few housekeeping items. First, this call is on the record, and we will email you a recording and slides after the webinar. Second, as part of your email confirmation, there is a link that says Open the Visual Interface. Click on that link to view today's presentation. The slides are also available on our website at businessfwd.org. Just look for the post advertising this event. If you have any problems, email us at info@businessfwd.org, and we'll help you out. Also, this is an interactive phone briefing, and there will be time for you to ask your questions and share recommendations. You can do this in one of two ways. You can press 1 at any time to ask your question live on the phone, or you can email the question to us at info@businessfwd.org. When we call on you to ask a live question, please introduce yourself with your business and where you're calling from. Please also try to include that information if you email us a question. Again, you can press 1 at any time on your dial pad, and you'll be put in queue to ask your question live, or you can send it to us via email to info@businessfwd.org. We'll add to the queue. Let's get started. Bob, the results are posted in the PowerPoint that we have. If we go to slide 2, Shumway, results show that the U.S. economy grew 3% in Q3. Was this a surprise, Bob?
Yeah, well, first I want to say just thank you very much for having me on the program. It's I think it's great that you. You have the segment focusing on the economy when we have these government releases of key government data. But to your question, I think it was a surprise. I think forecasters and so on were really expecting GDP to be in maybe in the mid-2s rather than up to the 3% range. And, of course, in the second quarter, it grew at 3.1, the first quarter at 1.2. But two consecutive quarters of 3-plus growth is hopefully it's the start of a trend. Speaking of trends, the trend growth rate after the Great Recession has been around 2.4%, and so this is above trend. And if this is sustained, it could have a significant impacts and affect decision making down the road. Let's say on the part of the Fed and the pace at which they raise interest rates. But also it may be reflective of changes in our labor markets, pulling people off the sidelines back into the workforce.
If we go to the next slide, slide number 3, contributions to GDP growth, which of these contributors do you think is most important, and where were the surprises?
Yeah, what's kind of interesting about this slide is that the growth, the 3% growth is pretty broad. It's not only it's not one thing driving it. Consumer spending, albeit lower than in Q2 in terms of the growth, 1.6 rather than 2.2, is still quite strong, higher than the first quarter. Private business investment, that is I think much stronger than was anticipated. You see the big uptick in inventories. That might be a matter of catching up, and so that might not have a long-lasting impact, meaning it may not carry over to Q4 or into next year's GDP growth. But business investment has remained strong. Residential as distinct from business investment, you know, has contracted. I think that was anticipated. It contracted less than it did in Q2. I think that the decline in the contraction is expected. Housing starts are still expected to be up. Government sector, a small decline. Exports, softening of the dollar, relative to where it was, you know, it was helpful there.
Go to slide number 4, consumer spending. We didn't get the drop that we expected related to Hurricane Harvey and Irma. Is that what's the big change here?
Yeah, I think I think folks weren't really sure how impactful the hurricanes would be early on. I think the sense was that they could be quite impactful, but I think as the weeks have gone by and it's become clear that they wouldn't be quite as impactful as initially thought. They probably have had some impacts on inflation, which we'll get to a little bit later, through energy prices and refining capacity.
And how does the consumer spending behavior last quarter correlate to consumer confidence?
Consumer confidence, it remains a fairly strong. And so again, I think the breadth of the results is reflective of an economy. It's it's probably at full employment. The unemployment rate is fairly low, a little over 4%. By historical standards, that's fairly low. The caveat there is the underemployment rate still remains a bit higher than one would expect at this stage of a recovery, and so there are people on the sidelines. So you can't just look at the unemployment rate. And we still seem to be producing the roughly 200,000 jobs a month.
We'll go to the next slide, business investment. What struck you about the results here with business investment?
I think it looks like it's fallen off since over the last couple of quarters, right? 7.2, 6.7, 3.9. But I think the expectation was really for business investment to be in the low single digits. Here it's a little bit closer to the mid-range. And that's one of the reasons that overall GDP growth rate is higher than we expected. There was the uptick in inventories, and so in terms of looking at this and how long lasting is it or not, that's something to always consider.
You mentioned that the business were catching up. What do you mean by that?
Well, inventories. As inventories get low, the manufacturer may go up simply to replenish inventories, and so there was a fairly significant uptick in inventories.
And are there any particular sectors that you think might be driving that growth?
I have not gotten that granular into the numbers to kind of look at the industry impacts. I know investment in business equipment has been particularly strong. Intellectual property products have been particularly strong. Investment in business structures, not quite as strong.
We move to the next slide, slide 6, non-residential investment trends. These are the numbers that you were just talking about.
So it's good that the slide reflects what I just talked about. But in any case, the construction, the decline, there you might perhaps that's partly explained by the hurricanes. The rebuilding will, there will be an uptick. You would expect a rebound there. The higher oil prices for a short period of time could also have impacts.
And moving on to the next slide.
Go ahead.
Oh, please go ahead.
No, actually, this is exactly what I was just about to talk about is residential investment, homes and so on. I think we would probably expect this to rebound.
as the rebuilding from the hurricane areas, it really ought to be lifting residential investments. Yeah, I'm not sure if the legend is exactly right on the bottom. I presume that is perhaps 1/4 off.
Oh, sorry, Q1, Q2, Q3, yes. I'm sorry about that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, when we go into Q4, you might expect an uptick, or certainly the negative won't be as significant.
And that is
the rebound. What's that?
What do you think drove the drop in Q2?
I'm not exactly sure what drove the drop in Q2. Mm-hmm.
And then moving on to the next slide, slide 8 on exports. Were these higher than expected?
Yeah, exports were. And there, I think, is the change in the value of the dollar relative to other currencies, the bit of softening we've had recently is giving us some advantage with respect to exports.
And does the softening of the dollar affect certain industries more than others?
Oh, yes, sir. Certainly exporters would be exporters would be impacted.
Well, I'm sorry, I meant different kinds of exporters, I guess.
I think one would have to look a little bit deeper and really look at the particular currencies and if you're a manufacturer and bringing in various commodities into the country, the value of those may have changed, or your retailer, depending on where you purchase from, the valuations on those would have changed just with the change in the exchange rate. So one would have to kind of puzzle through. Although the dollar softened, did it soften the same across all currencies?
And then the final slide is inflation. It seems like this is probably one of the more noteworthy changes this quarter.
Yeah, I think when people look at the macro, the macro economy, a lot of people at a high level look at the GDP, gives one a sense for the overall health of the economy. You look for a consistent pattern over time, and we're seeing a kind of a more of a consistent pattern of perhaps a little bit stronger growth. It'll be interesting Q4 if that's in the 3% range, then it looks more like a trend than just 2 quarters of positive growth. The other two things people look at is inflation and labor markets. And labor markets continue to tighten, and inflation continues to move around as you can see from this chart, the 1.5% to 2% range. Yeah, sometimes a little bit lower. The reason people look at the labor market, one of the reasons they look at the labor market and inflation is those are the two of the key things that the Fed is watching in their determination of what to do with interest rates, whether to increase them going forward. With the labor markets, fairly kind of indicative of a full employment economy, they are also looking for inflation to get back up to the 2% range. And it's interesting, when you look at forecasts on a quarter-by-quarter basis, as time goes on, it seems that it's always the case, 1 or 2 or 3 quarters from now is when we expect forecasters expect the inflation rate to get back to 2%. But it hasn't yet gotten there. And so, but the expectation, just like it was last year and the year before, is for towards the end of the year for inflation to have an uptick and get close to the 2% range. And so, what the Fed might do with respect to interest rates, that is going to weigh heavily. And I think just reading the Wall Street Journal and so on is not newfound information. But with the tightening of the labor markets, I think. And inflation close to their target, and the expectation is that they will raise interest rates. I think the strong GDP growth in this quarter contributes to that expectation. Then the question becomes how much will they increase interest rates? And so I think the expectation is that at the lower bound it would be at least 25 basis points, but it could be 50 or 75 basis points.
How quickly would that have an impact, do you think, on some of the numbers, the expectations for Q1 2018?
Yeah, I mean, usually interest rate changes. If you're setting policy, if you're in the administration, you're at the Fed. The thought is they take a while to work their way through the economy. The impact on borrowing costs, particularly short-term borrowing costs initially, and then so on. So they usually are thought to have a 6 to 18 month. It takes 6 to 18 months for their full impact. Now, I think in this instance, the one caveat would be is it's there's been an expectation, and the Fed has been more transparent, I believe, I think, in the last several years in terms of directionally where they're headed. And so some of the increase in interest rates that we will see are better reflected in expectations. And so I think
They're
there's
baked
more
in.
of an anticipation effect. And so I think that the result of that is one would tend to see the impacts a little bit sooner. We probably have seen the impacts a little bit sooner over the last year or two than if you turn the clock back a decade, because of the greater transparency of the Fed.
Well, Bob, you're one of the nation's leading experts on tax policy, and we've got Ways and Means about to release their plan probably next week, I believe. What do you expect, and what should business leaders be paying particular attention to?
Yeah, it's a very exciting time to be working on tax policy. Tax policy is one of the things that can move the economy in both the short term and the long term. And periods of economic distress, oftentimes you see the stimulus provided in the form of not only spending but also stimulative tax policies like 50% expensing for equipment, the bonus depreciation provision that's been put in place over the last several recessionary periods. But it's not only exciting, it's tumultuous. There's a lot of uncertainty. The unified framework released at the end of September by the House Republicans, Senate Republicans, and the administration was intended to serve as a template and to give some direction to the Senate Finance Committee, the Ways and Means Committee, in terms of what they would develop. They don't have to follow it, of course, but it was intended to give them some direction. It was also intended to, be a bit more transparent to give people a sense for where they are headed. And so there are a couple of key elements, right? So one, in terms on the business side, tremendous interest in lowering the corporate rate. And so I think one would expect, a corporate rate in the 20% range. What we'll see in the ultimate final package is, may be different than that, but I think one would expect a 20% rate in what we see in the next week or two from the chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee. Some other things we should expect is a measure of expensing. The unified framework was suggesting 5 years of 5 years of 100% expensing for what 167 property, or I guess gets for equipment. It might extend to intangibles, and then kind of left it open in terms of what the committees would do thereafter. But one might expect perhaps they would turn to 50% permanent 50% bonus in the second 10 years, maybe more. It's an open question whether they would have any faster write-off for investment of building structures. Currently, most of that's at 39 years. Apartment buildings are 27 years. So one could conceivably see them having faster write-off for there. Also, if you turn the clock back to last June of 2016, when the House Republicans released the House blueprint, that, of course, had 100% expensing for all investment in equipment, structures, and also inventories, but not land. But it was very, very expensive. They dropped, and it's very, very, very clear that border adjustments are not going to be seen for a long time. in tax plans put forward by Congress, and that leaves a revenue hole and would make doing 100% expensing extremely difficult from a revenue perspective. One thing I should mention is that the budget resolution gives provides a path for the Congress, House Ways and Means, and the Senate Finance Committee to develop packages that would add about $1.5 trillion to the deficit, which makes putting together a package much easier than trying to get it to be revenue neutral under current law. Tax reform is sometimes compared to a poker game where everyone comes to the table with the same amount of money, and then the aggregate amount of money they all leave with is the same, but there are winners and losers. With tax reform, the hope is with the policies, the set of policies, you'll have some economic growth that will expand the pie, and the aggregate amount of money at the poker table will actually increase. But you're still going to have winners and losers. But with the $1.5 trillion, which is a placeholder in part for the cost, the difference between the policy baseline and the current law baseline, that's in the order of $300-400 billion. But the other roughly $1.1 trillion is a placeholder for the potential feedback effects that would be associated with the program tax reform plan. So I mentioned corporate rate reduction down to 20%. Another area that one should, I think, will likely expect some type of limitation on the deductibility of interest expenses. And so that's, I think, something that people will want to look at very closely. Germany has a 30% of EBITDA limitation in place. The UK has a proposal in their budget for a 30% of EBITDA limitation. And because they're in a parliamentary system, what they propose in their budget often becomes law and becomes law, in a particular cycle, a little bit different than, the system we have. So I mentioned expensing, 50%, 100% expensing, followed by probably something for the second 5 years, maybe beyond. Probably a lot of base broadening on the business side to help pay for the other elements of the package. There's an indication that they are research and experimentation tax credit that's been in place since 1983 will remain. And there are a few other provisions that they indicated would remain. But all the other provisions are kind of on the table, and one would need to make a presumably a strong argument for them to be retained. On the household side, there's a focus on rate reduction, and also a focus on I would call it a combination of middle income tax cuts combined with simplification, and it's we'd see a standard deduction going up by a lot, which is in one part a form of relief, but it's also a form of simplification because it reduces the need of may reduce the need of many taxpayers to have to file a Schedule A and claim things like the home mortgage deduction, charitable deductions, and so on. The state and local tax deduction has gotten a lot of attention, so that is clearly something that may be included in a package, potential repeal limitation. Same thing with the home mortgage interest deduction. I think that is getting a very careful look. But with the increase in the standard deduction, some of what taxpayers would have claimed when they itemize to write off their state and local income taxes or property taxes or sales taxes, depending on what state you live in, or their home mortgage deduction, some of that in effect gets embedded into the standard deduction. So that's the number of rate brackets would likely decrease to 3 or 4. So I think unclear what the top rate bracket will be set at, probably somewhere between 35 and 39.6.
And we've got a lot of businesses participating in this call and in the network who are pass-throughs. What do you expect for that?
Yeah, that's a it's an important question. It's a big question. It's been one of the areas of uncertainty in the tax reform debate over the last 5, 6, 7 years. It's also a very difficult area. You have labor income, your wages gets taxed at ordinary rates. That's straightforward. When you have your corporate income, that's again being taxed at the investor level as gains, dividends, and so on. It's taxed at the under the corporate income tax system. But the corporate income tax is ostensibly taxing the return to equity investment because debt is fully deductible at the business level, at the corporate level. But pass-throughs, is more of a mixed bag. An S corporation partnership receives pass-through income when it goes to their owners. In many cases, it's a combination of the return to labor and the return to capital, and that makes it very difficult in any tax system, any income tax system, to figure out what is the best balance. But to get to the kind of where the House Ways and Means Committee will likely land, the expectation is you'll have a nominal pass-through rate of 25% on some portion of pass-through income. But then the trick is the question is we don't know what portion of pass-through income it will apply to. Some pass-through income may be subject to might be subject to the ordinary tax rates. The House blueprint suggested the IRS would administer reasonable compensation rules, which means that pass-throughs, partnerships, as well as S-corps, which already do this, would pay their owners, would be required to pay a reasonable level of compensation, and the IRS would need to administer that. That would be very complex and very hard to administer. I think a lot of thought has gone into what the alternatives might be. But whether you're an active partner or a passive owner partner, whether you're actively managed in the business and the type of investment, all of those things can play into what rules they come up with. That may well be one of the areas of greater uncertainty in where they'll land. Yeah, I didn't talk about the international area. I don't know if there how many people on the phone call are concerned about the international tax rules, but there the sense is we move to a territorial system, there would be a deemed repatriation or toll charge on that roughly $2.6 trillion in unrepatriated earnings that are held overseas by U.S. headquartered global companies. So that would be brought back or could be brought back, but it would be a deemed repatriation for that. There will likely be some type of rules, what are called thin cap rules that would try to address the idea of base erosion. The OECD had a project for the last few years that was very, very much focused on that.
So let's open up to questions from folks on the call. If you have a question, please press 1 to speak live on the call, or you can just email it to us at info@businessfwd.org. Please remember to introduce yourself with your business and where you're calling from. We've already gotten a number of questions that relate to the U.S. growth versus competing markets. One from John Daniels in San Antonio is, how do business conditions in the U.S. compare to other major markets?
The U.S. economy continues to grow. I mentioned the trend growth rate of 2.4%. You turn the clock back a decade ago, and before the Great Recession, the full employment growth rate was probably thought to be around 3.1%. Now it's because partly demographic changes, with a larger portion of the population in retirement as the baby boomers retire, that's fallen to the 2.4%. You've seen that the growth in the last two quarters over 3%. above that trend, probably above the full employment growth rate, which might be, you know, we might be able to sustain that for a while by decreases in the underemployment rate, if you will, to some perhaps some additional capacity that can be brought into the economy there. How do we compare to other countries? We continue to grow faster than Europe. We continue to grow faster. Similar to Canada, faster than Japan. Chinese growth is for them to be kind of at what you would think of as a full employment situation, full employment economy, they really kind of have to grow at over 6.5% because of the structure of their economy. But they are kind of slipping kind of below some of those levels. It's kind of hard to tell exactly how fast they're growing. There are a number of the Chinese government puts out estimates. There are some private sector estimates. The IMF, World Bank, and so on also have estimates. And they're all a little bit different, but kind of all mostly in the 6 to 6.5% range. The Eurozone is recovering, and their growth rate has been going up. The UK, the impacts of Brexit are less significant than originally thought, so they're also doing reasonably well.
Thank you. Next question is from Carrie Baines from the Alpha Strategy Group. Her question is, where do you see tax cuts as being the most efficient tool for stimulating the overall economy? Is there any particular sector of the economy that was most impacted by the recession that needs to be paid special attention by Congress?
Yeah, that's a great question. The tax policy and putting together a tax reform plan can have many different objectives. One could structure one. You just go down the list of what they might be. You could structure maybe not to be revenue neutral, but maybe to raise revenue to address the longer term fiscal imbalance. You would need to consider the distributional effects of a tax reform plan. Is it regressive? Is it progressive? Is it providing more relief to the middle income? Is it providing more relief to low-income people? What's it doing to high-income people? And then you also have to kind of consider what is it doing to the economy in the short run versus the long run. It's one thing to focus on long-run growth, but if that comes at the cost of short-term growth or creates possible unintended consequences from the disruption to the economy or the adjustments that would need to occur in response to a tax reform, those are things that's why tax reform is so hard. There are winners and losers, using the poker game analogy, you can address that if you have sufficient economic growth. But if you want to have more long-term growth, it's probably more adjustment in the near term because you're making more significant changes. So with that context, what economists who work on these issues tend to find that those tax policies that are more forward-looking, where the benefits are more forward-looking, are more impactful, but with some really significant caveats. So there's often a question of whether expensing is, how does that compare to lowering the corporate tax rate and the corporate income tax rate? And expensing is generally thought, depending on the transition that's provided to undepreciated basis at time of enactment, it's generally thought to be forward-looking because you're providing faster write-off of investment placed in service going forward. But again, depending on the transition relief, it may or may not provide any additional benefits to investment that's already placed in service. And you think of it for a minute, if you're trying to drive investment in capital accumulation, you can't affect economic growth by providing benefits to investment that's already placed in service. So from an economic efficiency perspective, you'll get bigger economic growth effects by making it entirely forward-looking and providing no transition relief. But for those industries and those companies that have already made a lot of investments and are on the old system, that there's a fairness issue there. It also can have large impacts on the valuation of assets. Those that receive expensing after would receive expensing going forward, as opposed to those who didn't have transition relief, those that would not. And so the valuation impacts can be quite large. Again, going to winners and losers. Corporate rate reduction lowers the tax on both old and new investments. So it's not it's not as forward-looking as expensing. So by and large, it may not, at least at first blush, may not be as economically efficient and drive long-run growth. But there are two important caveats, and probably many others. One important caveat would be what is the transition regime under under expensing. I already talked about that. The other important caveat is that lowering the corporate rate provides very general benefits from an economic efficiency perspective, because it treats a broad range of activities kind of more equally. It's a high tax rate interferes with decision making. The efficiency loss of a high tax rate is not it's related to the square of the tax rate, not the tax rate itself. And so as the tax rate goes up, those efficiency costs to the economy that reduce the productive capacity of the economy become more and more important. So that's one thing. I guess the third thing I would mention is internationally, a lower corporate tax rate could have very significant effects on where companies choose to locate income and deductions globally. And this goes into kind of the profit shifting base erosion debate, and there are estimates out there that suggest that could be a very significant, profound benefit of a lower corporate rate that wouldn't be as significant with expensing. So there are lots of trade-offs, but some blend of rate reduction, faster write-off of business investment, which is the direction they're going in, we'll likely see, and I think those will be conducive to a growth. Expensing will tend to benefit capital-intensive companies. So you can think of like heavy manufacturing, whereas rate reduction will tend to benefit from a relative perspective other companies. So you might think of like finance, real estate, insurance. I haven't talked about yet the interest deduction, the limitation on the deductibility of interest expenses, but that would be another thing to keep one's eye on. There are very significant differences in companies' leverage. A lot of small businesses they rely on debt. A lot of large businesses rely on debt. It's the availability of debt finance and equity finance is important efficient functioning of the private sector. But where there's been policy concern is whether there is an existing tax bias that favors debt financing over equity financing. And with the interest limitation, in part, that's what they're trying to address. It's also related to the base erosion issue.
We've got a few questions that relate to growth projections, and that cuts to the point you were making before about winners and losers, but hopefully everyone wins a little bit. A quote from Eric Kilburn from Los Angeles. President Trump said the U.S. should be growing at a rate of 4% annually. Is that type of growth achievable in the near future? What would it take to get us there? And if we don't reach that, what's the impact on the debt?
Tax policy is one of the government policies that can be help drive economic growth. Not the only one. Immigration policy is important. Infrastructure could be quite important. There are lots of research suggesting the economic growth effects associated with infrastructure, education policy is real important, perhaps in some instances for a longer run, but also has other is important for other reasons. Policies that affect the development of new technologies and the use of new technologies in processes can be quite important. But tax policy is one of the areas. With a tax reform, a progressive tax reform plan, if that's what we see, one should might expect a kind of a quickening growth rate. But ultimately, what we would likely see is the growth over a period of time, which could well be a decade, maybe even longer. We would see the growth rate eventually come back down to what economists would call the steady state growth rate of the economy, something close to or at the full employment growth rate of but what the tax reform will see, particularly like a policy, for example, like expensing, and to some extent with lower tax rates generally, you would see greater capital accumulation. You would see more investment. With more investment, you see greater capital accumulation. With that larger capital stock, workers have more capital to work with. They can work more efficiently. Capital labor ratios, capital intensity increases in the overall economy. And over a period of time, the economy grows faster. Then when you get back to the steady state growth rate, the economy is that much larger. Maybe it's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6% larger than it would have been otherwise. And kind of the work we've done at EY on doing these types of this type of macro modeling of policy changes in both on the regulatory side, spending as well as tax policy. People mentioned the long run. We have found that in a lot of tax policies, you get to about 2/3 to 3/4 of the long run impact by about year 10. So it's not when John Maynard Keynes had this line, in the long run we're all dead, but we'll get 3/4 of the way there, 2/3 of the way there by the end of the 10-year budget window.
So we've got just a few more minutes for the call. We have a question by caller Diane Thomas. Diane, you are now live. Hello, Diane.
Hi, Diane. How are you?
Give it one more minute. Diane? Well, she may have dropped off. This could be a long conversation. I know we're getting close to the end of the call, but we've had a couple questions that relate to the next Fed chair and whether you see any differences in terms of economic what the differences would be between the leading candidates for the position, including whether to keep Janet Yellen.
Yeah, that's an issue I will not involve myself in.
I think that's probably a wise
thing. And I think I think everyone listening will think that's a very good decision.
Well, I think that we had three questions on that, so I thought I'd try. But
right.
Well, Bob, thank you very, very much for your joining us today and for answering the questions. Everyone on the call, please check your email for recording of today's call and a quick survey. We're always trying to improve the quality of our programming, and we'd really appreciate any feedback you have time to provide. And we will be sending an email with future calls. We're going to be doing a number of calls on tax reform over the next few months as proposals come out, and we look forward to having you join us. Bob, Carol, thank you again for joining us. We really appreciate it.
Absolutely, and thank you for having me. It's a real pleasure.
Yeah. Bye.